Well, hello to everyone. By my clock, we are at the bottom of the hour. My name is Paul Weber, and this is the teleclass Ethics of Care During a Pandemic Crisis. On behalf of the co-founder of Teleclass Education, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to say how pleased we are that you have made this time to spend in what may prove to be one of our most challenging teleclasses in a long while. Our faculty today is Dr. Eric Wasilenko. Dr. Wasilenko is the medical advisor to the Regional Clinical Ethics Service in the Calgary Health Region. He has insight into this topic that I've heard nowhere else. In fact, he is an outstanding speaker. I have heard him speak, and I have read some of the things he's written, and I'm excited about this topic. It's a real honor to have him give the presentation. And when I said that it will be a challenging teleclass, there are some slides further on in the presentation that ask those "what would you do if" sorts of questions that I find so difficult, and I'm glad I don't have to answer them for real just yet anyway. So I will invite Dr. Eric Wasilenko to begin the presentation, Ethics of Care During a Pandemic Crisis. Dr. Wasilenko.
Thanks very much, Paul, and welcome to everybody listening in. Nice to hear there are so many of you from widely disparate areas. Much of my talk will focus from my cultural and location background, which is in Western Canada on the North American continent, and so I apologize if some of this isn't quite as relevant to other health systems. However, I think that much of what we'll talk about today is really quite relevant to all. So you've got some slides in front of you, and I'll zip through these fairly quickly. I want to first start by acknowledging a few people that I've collaborated with, read about their work, and also worked with in developing some of these concepts. Yaro Kotelic, who is an ethicist from Lakehead University in Ontario, who has written some great documents summarizing much of the literature, and we've co-presented at some national fora. Bashir Jawani, who's an ethicist from British Columbia, who I've worked with, the Calgary Health Region, who's developed a significant substantial amount of work and documentation on pandemic preparedness, and the Joint Centre for Bioethics, University of Toronto, who have written some great pieces, especially related to the lessons we've learned from the SARS crisis in 2003. So my objectives today are to inform and shape on the place of ethics when we plan for and manage during a pandemic crisis, and how ethics and the concepts within ethics may help guide our particular work in planning, but also in service delivery. I want to review some of the moral decision-making we'll have to undertake as care providers and planners and managers in an altered and unfamiliar care scenario, because deeply into a pandemic, if one should occur, we will be in a very different care scenario than we're used to in our everyday operations. And then I want to finally highlight some self-care issues within the duties of care that we have to others, but also to ourselves and to our families. And those are some of the tensions that people feel when they're thinking about what they may do should a pandemic arise. So really, I want to advocate for provider awareness of a change in ethical imperatives during a pandemic so that people can be prepared, and morally prepared and intellectually prepared, in advance of the time a crisis may hit. I will argue for a provider's duty of care, but the reciprocal duties of society to providers, if society will expect us to be care providers. And I'll talk about the moral and practical preparation of ourselves and others as well. So the outline really for this next hour will be that I'll start by trying to demonstrate how provider-patient ethics might change as we move through the stages of a pandemic crisis, and I'll argue for a little more depth about how we understand the various stages of a pandemic crisis. I'll discuss the issue of professional duty as it's juxtaposed against personal duties, and discuss the risk decisions and personal preparedness that we may undergo as we move through stages of such a crisis. I'm going to start just with a little bit of context. This isn't a very substantial bit of epidemiologic modeling, but are a few slides that just put into context some of the crisis that we may hit when we're talking about operational planning and management during a pandemic crisis. I should say as well from the start that I'm lots of people, when they talk about pandemic, estimate or suggest that we will have a pandemic crisis. It's not a matter of if, but of when. I'm not certain that I'm in that camp. I think that there is a very strong possibility we will have a pandemic crisis. We don't know how deeply such a crisis will hit. There's lots of great work on preparing for one and also on some management strategies and some medical strategies to mitigate the risks, the morbidity and mortality that may occur. We may have substantial things that are discovered that will allow us to manage much more effectively than we're worried about currently. So I certainly don't ever want to give people the impression that it's an absolute assuredness, but many of you are in this field and you will all have your own opinions about whether or not we are more or less likely to be hit with a pandemic crisis. Despite that, I think it is our absolute obligation as health systems and as providers, and certainly as a population, as a society that cares for each other, to be as maximally prepared as we can, even to the point of diverting some resources towards the planning, the stockpiling, the preparation, all the kinds of things that we'll need to do to manage. Because if the crisis does hit, it will be us who are dependent upon to be managing for society and for those we serve. So from a context point of view, and this is about slide six, we believe and think the epidemiologic modeling is that there will be two or more waves lasting about 6 to 8 weeks, several months apart. There may be more than two waves. Incubation for what we're presuming may be offending pathogens would likely be 1 to 3 days. And, of course, infectivity for such agents begins usually just prior to symptoms. So people, before they even know they're ill, are transmitting the illness. And that's one of the reasons why pandemics are so easily developed. We believe droplet isolation will be a mechanism, but that's not assured, and there certainly is lots of debate currently in Canada about whether or not normal surgical masks may be an effective agent, or in fact if we need N95 fit mask types for protection. So that's not an assured issue as yet. We believe symptoms will be for about 5 to 8 days in healthy people, and a recovery period would occur over a couple of weeks. Now, as you're all aware, there have been documented cases up until April of this year in 12 countries throughout the world. There have been 291 documented cases and 172 deaths, and that's the WHO statistics. So we see from that that there's a very high case fatality rate. As we know from our epidemiologic modeling, that is drastic, it's dastardly, it's a high case fatality rate, but on the small good side or the silver lining side, we can say that a disease that has such a high case mortality rate has much less chance of being spread as a pandemic because people are too ill to be out and spreading illness. So there is some silver lining in that, but we don't know yet if a pandemic hits, if it will be in fact this current agent, and if the illness will be as have such a high case mortality rate. We recognize that there will be cases that have not been documented, and certainly that the living conditions of the in the places and the people who have become ill from what's presumed to be avian flu are very different than in different parts of the world. And so the amount of viral load that people who have been infected in a documented way and have died is very different than others may encounter. So next slide, looking at from an example point of view at the Calgary Health Region where I live, we have about 1.2 million people in our integrated system that we serve. We believe that based on our modeling in Canada and from CDC that we will probably have about 660,000 people infected. Up to almost 500,000 would need some form of outpatient care. 8,700 people would be hospitalized, and we'd have about 1,600 deaths in two waves. So that's a huge burden of disease on a system that's already strained to capacity. We have in our system only about 2,100 staffed acute care beds. We only have 57 ICU beds and 186 ventilators that are operational, including ventilators in people who have long-term ventilation needs in the community. So we have very few resources available for an illness where people will suffer dramatic morbidity and mortality, primarily from respiratory illness complications. So you can see from that we do not have the resources to manage at all. And since the pandemic isn't just in one isolated geographic area, but by definition is widespread, every other system will be in this same bind that we're in. So we won't be able to borrow or ramp up production of the kinds of equipment and people needed to manage in a pandemic circumstance. And that's where some of the ethical issues come to play. So we're fortunate, at least in our region, we have a fairly mature, integrated, multi-sector system, so we have responsibility for every bit of the health system, for protection and promotion of health, for home care, acute care, long-term care, the emergency system, the triage and early responder system, etc. So it's involved in all, and that helps us certainly plan and distribute resources effectively. So on to the next slide. I want to talk a little bit about some ethics background, just some fundamental principles that we use for decision making. And I believe most of you would be very familiar with these common principles that we talk about all the time: respect for autonomy and beneficence, non-maleficence and justice. And really those are the fundamental principles we use in a principle-based ethic framework. Now, I recognize there are many other ethical frameworks others use, including feminist ethics and relational ethics and the such. This is not the only one, but it is one that certainly helps us as providers to get a disciplined way of using a framework to address ethical and moral dilemmas. I won't go into each of those in detail because I think most people are very familiar with them, as they are the most common. But there are other key concepts that we use every day in our ethics deliberations to help people address moral dilemmas. And I wanted to go through a few of them because they will be relevant in the decisions that we have to undertake. So the next two panels, name those, and I'll move on to describe each of them in a little bit of detail. So we'll go on to the slide that says key concepts, starts with proportionality. The ethics concept of proportionality talks about our duty to provide a proportionate response, a response that's in proportion to the degree of harm that would entail to the population or to an individual if we didn't invoke a particular measure. We want to be as least intrusive as possible. So, for example, in the SARS crisis in the Greater Toronto Area in 2003, 25,000 people were quarantined. Now, that's a really dramatic response in a country like Canada where we value so highly our individual liberty. And we're not used to having our ability to move and associate with whomever we want and go out wherever we want to be constrained. This was a justified response in the SARS circumstance because we didn't have an effective way to treat people who became ill, and we didn't know enough about the illness then, so it wasn't a very appropriate response. Less dramatic illness and one that we know lots about would not necessarily justify that intrusion into our civil liberty. So that's an example of where our measures on a broad population scale or on an individual care provision circumstance need to be in proportion to the degree of harm otherwise. Second concept is of transparency, and we do this all the time in our health system and in provision of care. We want to make sure we inform and include those who will be most affected by the various decisions or remedies that we employ. So although we say we do it, we often aren't all that good about it, and that's part of the measures that people are starting to talk more about, that we include patients and families in centered care rather than being a command-control service provision as has been in the past. In the circumstance of pandemic, we have to inform and include those people who will be most dramatically affected by what happens. So there is a call from an ethics point of view to make sure that we do inform the public and we do include them in the plans, because the measures that will be invoked will affect them dramatically. Similarly, we need to include and inform people who are providing services and who are being asked to be an essential worker, whether or not it's in the health system or not. So that's a very important concept. Early on in our planning, lots of people were saying, well, we're going to frighten the population too much. We have to just keep the conversations to ourselves. And many of us argued against that because that sort of patronizing or paternalistic stance, which some might justify, it doesn't hold for us relating to this concept. Next panel, there's two key concepts, reciprocity and duty of care. So reciprocity talks about our duty to provide for people who are restricted or compelled. And again, in the SARS example, when people were quarantined, we can't just quarantine people and say, okay, now they're taken care of. We have to make sure that they have access to social contact, to health care, to basic food and water and shelter, to medicines, all those sorts of things. Similarly, those people who are compelled to work, if that's going to be one of the strategies that are employed, have to have some form of safety, compensation, etc. So reciprocity, although it's not a word we commonly use in our language, it is certainly a key concept that we actually do employ in our everyday work and will be magnified during a time of pandemic. Duty of care talks about our need to fulfill the unique functions that we're serving as healthcare providers for those who are needing our services as experts. Next panel talks about avoidance of collateral damage and privacy. So avoidance of collateral damage really is a reference to the effect on patients who are already receiving care or who are waiting for care. And there will be dramatic collateral damage during a pandemic. And then privacy, of course, we hold very dearly in the health system. We want to protect personal health information. But there will be a different degree of attention to that principle versus the need for public safety. And some we will see as time goes on and as we get deeper into a pandemic crisis that the need for privacy will be devalued partly in the interests of the need for public safety. So that's just a point to recognize that we will have to prepare ourselves for acting a little bit differently in those kinds of frames. The next panel talks about duty to accommodate, and we do this every day. We balance staff assignments against personal circumstances, and the example I would use is the pregnancy example. So if there is the risk of harm to a woman who is pregnant and to her unborn child by fulfilling a certain task, and another worker would not have the same harm attached to him or her, we would usually ask the other worker to do the particular job. And we manage it that way all the time in our health systems. We would certainly want to continue doing that during the time of the pandemic. Solidarity talks about connection between and within health systems out of mutual interest for our common needs and so that we can be consistent and fair, coming back to the principle of justice, that everybody is treated reasonably equitably. All right, so the next panel, I'm just going to start talking about the WHO and Health Canada's phase assignments and just challenge that a little bit from an operational planning need point of view. So as you're all aware, and I think there is some work going on currently within WHO about these phase assignments, but there are 1 to 5 inter-pandemic phases and alert phases. We're currently in phase 3, meaning that there have been human cases, but there's no sustained human-to-human transmission or spread. Phase 6 is labeled the pandemic response time, and then there's a post-pandemic recovery time. Now, many of you who are doing operational planning within your systems are very interested in the planning phases and the inter-pandemic phases. I think that's important. However, in the operational phases of a pandemic, I don't believe that the way we've categorized it is going to be helpful enough. So what? Moving on to within phase 6 Calgary stages slide, what we've done is taken phase 6, which is the pandemic response time, and divided it into 5 separate stages that I believe will help us more operationally decide what we're going to do. One of my challenges is that we tend to say no pandemic versus full pandemic. What are we going to do in the 2 different scenarios? Well, we all know that there will be stages that we will go through, and the way we will manage will be different depending on how deeply involved we are with the pandemic in our own particular areas of responsibility geographically. So that's why we've divided these into these stages. And I think they make some sense from an operational point of view. So the first would be, you know, we wake up one morning and there's an index case somewhere in Canada or the United States. If we're talking about the North American continent, it would be the same for any other area of the world when there's a some geographic proximity, but it's not within your health system yet. The day that happens, there's going to be some operational things that are triggered within your environment from the detailed planning that you've done that will change the face of healthcare for providers and for patients, their access, etc. And so we have to be prepared for that. The next stage would be there would be a Calgary area case, and I use that example just because that's where I am from. So a Calgary area case arrives. That changes the kinds of things that we'll be doing operationally. The next stage would be that there would be limited cases with the potential for widespread. The next stage would be that extensive disease burden has already been established. And the final stage, which of course we hope we never get to, is that there would be widespread disaster. Then of course there's recovery and return to normal operation and waiting for the next pandemic wave to hit. So next panel just talks a little bit about the change in provider-patient ethics. We usually, in our systems, start everything we do, like in triage, with fairly egalitarian principles. So we talk about who's in greatest need of care when we do triage, and that person, in the main, usually gets our attention primarily. All things considered, we treat people equally because we believe they're of equal worth, and that's the way we usually operate. But there will be a change in provider-patient ethics, as I say on the next slide, that we gradually shift to utilitarian principles more prominently as we get into a pandemic. So we're trying to maximize overall good of society, and the direct patient interests may be subservient to the common good. And when you think about it, really everything we do is to maximize the overall good of society, even in today's normal working environment in healthcare. But it will be much more obvious during that kind of situation. Now, that's going to be a real challenge for providers. It certainly is for me as a physician when my duty really, although I have to think about the broader health system and the resource allocation within it, my primary duty is to help the person who's right sitting with me before me asking for my help. And that really, other things are subservient to that. But I may be challenged by the person who might be in charge of my operational area to say, no, Eric, you must leave that patient, and I need you to come and do this different job to help a larger group of people to manage and to survive through this crisis. And that's going to be a really big challenge for us as clinicians to do. And that's one of the reasons why I say we need to be prepared morally and intellectually in advance. I'm going to switch on to the next slide now and start talking about each of those stages in a little bit more detail. So stage one, an index case happens in your general geographic location on your continent within the normal travel areas that you're exposed to. We'd still have some near normal operational capacity and triage decisions and HR functions, but there would be early restriction of civil liberties. For example, travel to and from the index area where the first case was discovered. Stage two happens when there's an index case in your particular geographic area within the area of responsibility that you have. And for us, that's the entire system in this area. For you, it may be a particular unit or a certain home care environment or a certain hospital. There would be, at this point, a shift in the normal healthcare functions near that index case. Collateral damage would occur. So if the first case was discovered in the emerge department or on the ward of one of our busy acute care hospitals, there would be lots of collateral damage within that hospital. We may quarantine that person or certain staff members who had had contact with the person, and all the other people around that person may not be able to stay, or they may be now quarantined. They may not get all the kind of care that they were initially planning to get, especially if they were, for instance, going on for surgery or for some other tests. So that would be an example of collateral damage. we would increasingly divert resources, and at that point we may be compelling immunizations and antivirals. Now, each place will have their own operational plan, and we're trying to make those consistent throughout our nations, at least, about at what point the triggers would say that we will start talking about immunizations and antivirals. And frankly, in the current WHO interpandemic phase, when we reach four, there would be automatic triggers for people to start doing things differently, increasing stockpiles, etc. But beyond that, we're talking about the pandemic phase now. So at next panel, stage three, there would be limited cases within our geographic area of responsibility with the potential for widespread. At that point, there would likely be suspension of some civil liberties. We would probably be saying people should not be congregating at schools and in churches, at malls, or other places. We would be altering sites of care and picking locations where the majority of people with potential pandemic would be cared for to try in some way to isolate, if that's felt to be an effective mechanism. We would alter our triage decisions at that point, and there would be major collateral effects. We would divert resources in a major way. I'm on to the next panel now. And there would be decisions for persons in care that's quite interesting. So there, just take the example of somebody who would maybe be undergoing some complex cardiac surgery or being entered into a treatment pathway for surgery for debulking a tumor and then entering a course of chemotherapy and radiotherapy. We recognize that there are a multitude of key steps that have to occur to get the patient to any semblance of wellness. So the surgery is really important, but that's not where it ends. And there are a multitude of things that must occur to have the person do their basic post-operative recovery. I'm not talking about return even just to full function, but their basic critical post-operative recovery. If we know that we're already into what we call stage three of a pandemic, and we may not have the human resources, the bed availability, or the physical and technical resources to be able to get that person back to some basic standard of health, then it frankly is likely unethical to actually enter that patient into this pathway of care. And that's going to be very challenging for our providers when, for instance, say I'm a cardiac surgeon or a neurosurgeon and here's what I do well and I really want to help these patients who've been on a waiting list for a number of months. If I now cannot provide my skill to this patient who needs my skill because we won't be able to carry on with his or her care, it's going to be a real challenge for providers. But it will be an important ethical decision at that point to say we should not provide this basic care or intervention for this person because we can't sustain their care pathway. And that's a really important thing that's going to be challenging for people. We will shift work assignments and then provider-patient autonomy, as I was speaking about before, as well as privacy, will be devalued against protection from harm. So it will be that many of us as care providers will not be able to carry on with our usual duties and help the patients and clients that we're meant to serve in our everyday healthcare environments. And that's going to be of dramatic challenge to us as providers, as it will be to those who are expecting us to be available to help serve them. And I believe that that will be the case for people at all levels and areas and sectors of the health system. So next panel, stage four, extensive disease burden has been established. We would by this time have shifted pretty completely, I believe, to utilitarian ethics, and we would be making decisions changed from who is most at risk of death to who can be saved and who, if treated, interrupts the spread of disease. So we would be changing, again, quite dramatically, the way that we usually think about who is going to get our attention next. Next panel, stage five, widespread disaster. I believe that the familiar command control functions of all public services will be disrupted, and there will be an increase at that point in individual beliefs that guide our everyday actions between professional duties, humanitarian calls, and personal family survival. What I'm arguing for is that at this point, people will not be listening to ethics frameworks or rules or anything else. They'll be their actions will be guided by their own individual beliefs. So we certainly need to hope we don't get to the point of widespread disaster. Now, I recognize there will be a tremendous number of people that are heroic and that will be compassionate and ethical. There will be some who will not be. And we use our social institutions and our frameworks of law and rules to try to guide our common behavior amongst each other. Those things will not be as effective at that point. I'm going to move on now, next slide. I'm going to talk about withholding and withdrawing treatment, just to highlight an issue that will come up for us. We face this often enough in the health system, but despite our constraints, at least in North America and Canada, we generally have the ability to treat people eventually. Although sometimes we do have to face this issue of withdrawing and withholding treatment, it will be a very common scenario in a pandemic crisis. So I'm using the example of a 60-year-old man who's got severe influenza, and he's requiring support of a ventilator, but he's failing, and there's little or no likelihood that he will survive. And in this scenario, respirators and ICU beds are in really short supply, and you happen to be the ICU physician, and you're told to remove your patient from the ventilator so that it can be used elsewhere for somebody else who it can hopefully be effective for. Remember, it's a very constrained supply. But you feel it's unethical to remove that life-sustaining and compassionate intervention once it's begun. So what do you do? Next panel just briefly highlights the issue about withholding and withdrawing treatment. Generally, in the ethics literature, there's felt to be no real ethics distinction. But there is a significant difference psychologically. The point is that we can begin treatment, and then it is ethical to withdraw that treatment if it's not meeting the intended purpose effectively. But easy to say, very hard to do. And where are the lines that we draw? So is it that we could say if somebody has a 10% chance of survival by carrying on with this ventilator, that's enough justification to carry on versus somebody else who may have a 40 or 60% chance of survival with it? We don't have any systems at all anywhere developed that will help us make those decisions really effectively. What's the difference between a number like 10% versus 40%, and where do we draw the line? There are no standard agreements about that, although people have been writing about and are working on ethics of triage in ICU in this kind of a scenario. So that's going to be a challenge for us. Moving on to the next slide, talking about professional and personal duty. I'm going to just ramp up a few scenarios and increasingly difficult ones for you to contemplate in your minds what you or your colleagues may do, or if you're a manager, what you may be compelling your staff to do. So let's take the case of a person who's a married mother of three school-aged children. Mother-in-law lives with the family. Pandemic alert's been called, and you're phoned in to come to your job as an infection prevention control nurse on your day off. And you could change this to any other person in the system. So I ask people when I'm giving talks in groups that I can get some feedback from, what are your duties? And I get people to sort of talk about why they think it would be their duty to come to work or not come to work. Most people at this say might at this point might not be that happy to come into work, but they say, yes, you know, I probably would once I made sure that my personal duties are taken care of. So next frame, ramp it up a little bit. So we say the next day you're called in again, but you're noticing that your mother-in-law is developing a fever and a cough. So you're called at noon and you're told that she's now in eMERGE, so your mother-in-law is taken care of, and that a neighbor who you trust will look after your children when they return from school. So they're taken care of as well. So I ask, now what are your duties? A few more people would say, well, you know, there's an illness in my home and I want to make sure that I'm protecting others at my work environment or potential patients, because it's obviously the disease is in my home now. And that's legitimate. However, in a pandemic, we recognize that the viral load will be everywhere and we will get it and transmit it from many, many sources. So I'm not sure that that argument holds enough water. Most people would still say, once my duties are cared for appropriately, personally, then I would want to go in and work. So next frame, the next day, your eldest child, who did receive the influenza vaccine through school a month ago, becomes ill. She has symptoms suggestive of influenza. Your husband's mildly unwell, and he's now at home. So when I'm in my talks, I try to insert a little bit of humor, and at this point, most of the women in the audience will say, well, what's your husband, where's your husband been all this time? And then others say, well, when have you ever seen a husband be mildly unwell? And I get to say that since I'm male. So the situation is they're now reaching a crisis at work. Many colleagues are ill, and you're called to come into work. At this point now, what are your duties? So you recognize there's lots more illness in your house. You're worried about your family, but the situation is getting quite dire at work. Do you have compelling duties to come into work, or should you be staying home? And then next frame, I ramp it up a little more intensely, and this is not an unrealistic scenario. Let's say your sister is a respiratory therapist and she has unique knowledge and skills in ventilated patients who have severe but reversible respiratory failure. Her husband's gravely ill with terminal cancer and is expected to live only 4 to 6 more weeks. Now, she's been on compassionate leave during this time, but her skills, which are in very short supply within your area, are needed in the ICU to help save patients. What are her duties now? Well, go back to some of those principles we talked about earlier, the duty for us to accommodate, or duty of accommodation, the ethics principle of accommodation, would say that if we could do anything to try to keep her at home, taking care of her husband and attending to those particular duties she has as a soon-to-be bereaved wife, that we should accommodate her and try to find somebody else to do her work. Now, it may be that in a pandemic with a large number of people off, we would not have that luxury at all. So how do we manage her duties and her requests? Lots of principles to talk about here, and I won't go into detail. Most people say, gee, she should have the opportunity to be at home and stay there. Her husband will not live longer, and if she goes to work and comes back, she may give him an illness that would cause him to die even sooner. It's important that we make sure we give some latitude for them to discuss this, and it may frankly be that her husband says to her, you can help me as much as you can. I want you here. I need you. But I also recognize that your whole life is about not only me and our family, but about your work as a respiratory therapist. You can help people, and I want to give you that opportunity. So he may, out of love and compassion, give her that freedom or latitude to go to work. Those are personal decisions that we need to allow people to try to work through and make on their own. However, the principles that I want to talk about really are how we can accommodate the unique features of people's duties to be at work as well as their personal duties in an appropriate way. So it may be that this person who should not be caring for her husband 24 hours a day without help anyway would have the opportunity for a few hours a day to come into work or to be able to provide at a distance conversations on the phone, for instance, some training for others to be able to do some of the work that she's been able to do. So finding a way to balance off her duties to make sure that she manages in the future, but that she's also had specific opportunities to help her husband are really important. Now, we need to remember as well that people will need to manage in the post-pandemic environment, and many will feel quite guilty about what they did or didn't do, feel very good about what they did or didn't do, and what their colleagues did or didn't do after the fact. So we have to always be attentive to that. My point's really going to be a bit of a claim that I'll make in a moment. So move on to the next slide. And I would say when trying to make these kinds of tough decisions, and they will be very challenging for each of us individually and as managers, I would ask these 5 questions. First, are professional codes relevant here? Well, they're very important, but frankly, I don't know of many people who look at their professional code of ethics every day and say, yes, this is how I'm going to guide myself today. We use them retrospectively, but really we have our personally developed internal codes that are informed by our professional codes. So then I would ask, can my personal duties be met by others, and can they be met in a different time frame? And in all the scenarios I've painted, they in fact can be, in different degrees. So if others are available to care for our personal responsible parties within our families, and that frankly in my view should be one of the things that society provides for us as healthcare workers, is the opportunity for those who are non-essential, as long as they're trusted and skilled, to be taking care of some of our personal duties so that we can continue to work in a balanced way, still taking care of our families, attending to our own personal needs, but being able to provide our resources. Lots of people in the health system say to me, well, I happen to be a nurse or I happen to be a physio or a physician. I've got special skills to take care of my family. I need to be there for them, and I'm a parent, so I deserve to be there for them. Well, frankly, that most of the care that we will be providing for people who are affected but not seriously ill from the illness can be managed by people that are not trained. So there's nothing specially compelling because we're healthcare providers that means we get to stay home and take care of our patients, and that's the argument I'd want to make. So the next thing I'd ask is, what contract does society have with me, and can society cope without any of me or similarly trained healthcare providers? And my claim is, on the next slide, that professional duties override personal duties when we have the skills that are necessary to save, protect, and treat others, and when there's a shortage of similarly skilled people, and when our personal duties can be met without undue hardship by others. So that's a strong claim. Not everybody agrees with it or believes it, but it is a claim that I'm prepared to argue for. The next frame talks about professional versus personal duty, saying that personal heroism, while it is laudable and we will see lots of it, is not morally required. But frankly, society has contracted with us by providing us with a unique set of skills, by granting us a place in the medical school or physio school or nursing school or whatever where we've been in. And when society has to call upon those skills in a time of crisis, then I believe that compliance with professional duty, even at personal risk, is morally required because there aren't others to do this for us. So people challenged me on that, and I was interested at a social event. A nurse I knew who happened to have three kids, and I didn't model my questions after her, but said to me, no, I'm a mother first, and I'm going to stay home and take care of my patients. And one of the challenges might be to say, if we really are essential workers, knowing that if none of us were around, the whole system would collapse, and we know it would, and that would have a dramatic effect on society. If I stay home to take care of my kids, do I have any ethical or reasonably practical way to argue that if a fire happens, that I can expect there's a fire service available to help protect me and my family? One of my kids gets really ill and I have to take them by ambulance to a hospital for treatment, can I reasonably expect there would be an ambulance service there for me? Because those people also have families that they can then justifiably stay home and take care of if I can do it for myself. If there is a marauding band of thugs, do I have any way to argue that I should expect I can call up 911 and get some police or protection services there to help me manage that crisis? We can't make that argument, and by extension, health providers, viewed as an essential service, need to be available in the collective frame to be able to care for the population who needs our help uniquely during a pandemic crisis. So that's the basis of my argument. So then we need to talk a little bit about what we really mean by personal risk, and because it's a matter of degree. So I won't go through this in tremendous detail. They're on the slides, and I think they're pretty self-explanatory. There are many different levels of personal risk, and we do have to think not only about physical proximate risk, but risk of things like moral and spiritual harm based on the decisions that we have to make. Then we can talk about what's an acceptable degree of risk and recognize that we really can't compel people to undertake risks that will cause them dramatic harm and have a high chance of occurrence. And a couple of frames down, I talk about those four sort of different grid patterns. When something has a chance of significant harm, a high risk of occurrence, it's really not likely to be acceptable for most people to be put in that position of risk. But at the end, when I say something that's of less consequential harm and has a low risk of occurrence, it really is okay for us to undertake that risk usually, and for us to push others who are under our employ, for instance, to be put in that risky environment. I'm going to flip forward a couple of frames and move on to the bottom of what I say is page 14, and we'll be sort of mid through page 7 of those who have a 6-panel page. It says professional versus personal duty claim. This is the reciprocal part of my claim of duty of care. Now, I would want to argue that to the extent that society's claim on our professional duty also puts us at significant risk, then the ethics principle of reciprocity requires that we be maximally protected from harm, that we have some commensurate compensation for our efforts, and that there is a duty to our dependents should we be harmed in the provision of our service. Now, every day I go into work voluntarily, you know, I get paid for my work, but I choose to take the risks that I face. I may be harmed in surgery when I'm operating, or I may be harmed on the road on the way to work. I may be attacked by a patient. All sorts of things could befall me. It's unlikely, and I accept that risk every day. But when I'm being compelled to work in a risky environment that some harm could come to me, there is a responsibility on the part of society who is requesting my help and demanding my help to make sure that the maximum protection is afforded me so that there's less risk of harm to me. We have models like this in the way we do or don't well treat our armed forces, their personnel, and their families. I do believe that we have a duty, a higher duty than we've often taken, to the dependents that are left should we be harmed or killed in the service of this compelled or forced duty, including in a pandemic environment. So what I would argue for is that we have to make sure that we've got some of those compensation and regulatory mechanisms in place in advance. And by doing that and assuring that, we will have a much greater chance of having our healthcare providers accept or acquiesce to our call and our demands for people to come into work. I'm going to skip by the ethics of triage slides. There's about five of them. They're pretty self-explanatory. And move on to the bottom of what I've called page 16, the frame that says what to do. So we'll need to manage a shift in duties and in awareness of ethical obligations in a really potentially short time frame, and in the midst of personal fear for all of us, in the midst of societal crisis. And the people that need to be shaped most critically are those who will be depended upon the most to manage during this crisis. And in our sphere, that's healthcare workers and planners. And so we need to do a very, very careful job when we have the time now to prepare all of us in the system. So what should we do? Well, we need to involve those who are affected, including staff and including the population. And that goes back to my earlier principles of the inclusiveness principle. So we have a duty to do that. We need to encourage intellectual and moral preparation. There's no way that we can expect for this dramatic shift in our moral thinking and in our sort of everyday operational planning that we can expect people to be able to make that shift in the midst of the crisis when they're really most focused on themselves and their families and some maybe not that well-developed principles of where their duties lie. So we have to prepare people in advance and get feedback from folks about, do these kinds of ethical frameworks make a difference? Do they help me make a decision in a tough environment? We need to also encourage practical individual preparation. We probably haven't done enough of that. So from an organization's point of view, our response for readiness needs to involve many, many things, and I've only named a few. There's a huge list of things that we need to do organizationally, and many places are doing this on a local level, on a sector level, on a provincial and a countrywide level, etc. We know it's happening globally as well. We need to make sure that we inform and educate the population, the providers, and our systems. Next slide, we need to make sure that from a readiness point of view, we've developed and advocated for people to take care of themselves. So self-care packs need to be developed and people need to be educated. We've got a very good system where I happen to live where people can phone for advice. Now that system will be overwhelmed, but we cannot rely on our health sector providers to be doing a lot of the very basic care that people will be able and should be able to do on their own for those who are not critically ill. Time to prepare is now, not when we're in the midst of a hugely constrained resource. We need to develop detailed care and service plans, and many of you are in the midst of that and have done a great job of working on those. They do need to be detailed and they need to be down to specific levels. So, for instance, in our North American system, in an integrated way, we may need to say, at what point will we say we will no longer be offering dialysis? And that's an example of a very challenging, difficult decision, because we realize we want to care for people and we want to make sure that they are cared for as well as we can from a compassionate point of view, whether or not they will live. We need to advocate for stockpiling of various things, and it's not just antivirals and immunizations. It needs to be things that people will suffer from when they have a severe or mild illness, including respiratory illness. So I'd be advocating for stockpiling of opioids that we would use for severe respiratory distress for those who are dying. Because even if someone's dying, we need to give them proper, appropriate palliative care. So some self-care packs and instructions about how people can self-administer would be important. I believe as well we need to make sure we have adequate stockpiles of antipyretics and anti-inflammatories, that we have adequate stockpiles of antibiotics, because those secondary respiratory illnesses that are frankly treatable will have a very constrained supply of the things that will help people from getting secondary or being treated for secondary bacterial infections. We have to develop effective distribution networks. Next slide, we need to make sure there is an ethics capacity that can provide guidance and decision-making at the time of crisis, both at the bedside and system-wide, because there is an ethical imperative that we have consistency in how we care for people and how we make decisions about when to or when not to stop or start certain kinds of care. For instance, how do we make a decision on the withdrawal of a respirator? If it's done differently in each different hospital or by each different provider, we haven't attended to that basic justice principle and fairness principle. We need to develop systems of compensation, regulatory and legal agreements, so people can be effectively knowing that they can change their healthcare imperatives and environments, and they will be supported in that. And we, of course, need to develop proper dispute resolution mechanisms. So close to the end, and I want to next talk about a bit of personal readiness. We need to make sure that, as I've argued, we have this moral readiness, that people are intellectually prepared and have at least thought about these things, figured out where they can go to for help when making these tough choices. We need to make sure policies are in place, that there is, and that we know those policies, so how we can act ethically and defend ourselves in our actions should we be called to task post-pandemic. We need to make sure that people have knowledge. We will be dependent upon, both on a personal level and on a professional system work level. We need to know as much as we can about the illness and our preparedness plans. We need to prepare ourselves and our families. There are, next slide, there is on the Canadian website some emergency planning guides for our families. I think probably most nations have this. I don't know if I'd say that they're well enough developed yet, and I think there are some other things. So I will talk about a few ideas as well that probably many of you will know already and have thought about. So the next couple of slides, I talk about that personal preparedness a bit. I would make sure that you've, as individuals, and for those who you might influence or educate, and I think this is for the whole population, I just get to the opportunity to talk to healthcare providers and planners, so I talk in that frame. We need to make sure that we have well-developed communication plans for those that we care for and care about and work with. We need to make sure there's travel plans for our family to know what will you do if one of your kids is away at university somewhere or in another country or a different part of your country, how will you collect together? Because people we will see will have a great need to do that collecting together. Make sure that if you are caring for children or relatives or seniors, that you have a plan for managing their care. Should you become ill yourself, or should you need to be in for work? That's very critical, because those will be some of the big tugs that you have. And as I argued before, we probably need our society to be a little bit more focused on figuring out ways that health providers or other essential workers can have some of their personal duties helped by others who will not be at work potentially, but will be available to help out. We need to make sure that we have a medication supply appropriately available for ourselves and for those we care for, whether they're prescription medications or they're over-the-counter medications. That's going to be a challenge. But I would argue that the more we can distribute effective amounts of mild stockpiling within our home environments, the less call there will be on runs on those limited supplies when the time comes. Part of my issue is that the first day that the population recognizes that there is a impending pandemic and it's going to hit your local area, at least in the western environment where there is access to lots of supplies of things, people will be racing to the store. And we've seen in just very mild situations of flooding or whatever within even our own country that the supplies of bottled water, for instance, are gone, you know, in a moment. We certainly don't want the first thing people doing would be to congregate at the department stores trying to stock up on supplies, but we know people will do that. So pet care, the emotional issues for lots of people, you need to have plans for that. We don't know what commodity will look like for trade, but it would be important, at least in our environment, to have some supply of cash available because the drivers who take cash to the bank machines, for instance, will not be available. They'll be under the weather as well. Business continuation plans for those who do have business or are responsible for employees. And then in the next slide, I talk about some of the basic things of life. So food, manual can openers, camp stoves, and gas. We don't know that we'll be able to, if we get deeply into a pandemic, depend on our grids for electricity, for clean water, for gas, etc. Those people will be affected who would normally maintain and secure those kinds of things. And if we're in the midst of a Canadian winter, for instance, or there's an environmental disaster in any other part of the world, we don't know that the services that can get those infrastructure things up and running again will be available as readily. So we need to not depend on things like electricity. I advocate for people to have enough drinking water at home to last for some days, and they continually rotate that as they're preparing for a time of crisis. People need to make sure they understand how they're going to get heat, proper sanitation. I'd argue for people, at least in our society, having water purification tablets available. Those things aren't in most people's homes, but again, we won't know that we can depend on appropriate water cleanliness for our basic functioning. And then sources of lights and batteries for us, and of course, safety protection. I don't like to, but need to highlight as well for people that when your neighbors know your health providers, you will have specific moral dilemmas when people come to your door and say, I suspect you probably have some supplies of things. I need this for my father or my husband or for my kids. Can you provide me with some of what you have? And there may be threats to you physically, but even if there isn't, there will be a challenge for you to decide, do I save these scarce supplies for myself and my family in case, or do I provide these for those who have come to my door for help? So we will be in that unique circumstance as health providers as well. On the last frame, I've provided a few references and acknowledgments that are useful things for you to look at if you want, and I'm sure and all of you have in your own areas and countries resources like this to refer to that may assist you in thoughts and planning in the areas that I've talked about today. So I'd like to end there and thank you all for listening and turn it over to Paul.
Well, Dr. Westlake, thank you very much. One of the complaints that we all hear occasionally about the lectures at conferences and, in fact, some of the teleclass lectures is that they're all about describing the present situation that we might face or what might be coming, but without providing real solutions and steps. Really grateful that you gave us so much of the what to do and how to do it sorts of things that are really, really very valuable. And I noticed that you provide your email address on the title slide, meaning I presume that you wouldn't object to people contacting you directly if they have questions.
Happy to respond any way I can.
You may regret doing that, but I'll but thank you for that. It really was an outstanding lecture. I'm so pleased, and I hope that you might entertain an invitation to future years as well.
Thank you. I'd be most pleased to, and I appreciate you having me speak today.
Thank you to everyone for joining this teleclass. A special thanks again to Dr. Wesolenko for really valuable information and ideas. I thank you very much. I'll look forward to meeting with all of you again very soon, and until then, goodbye.